Let's Talk Development, Season 2, Episode 6.
Assalamu alaikum and hello everyone. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Development, a podcast series hosted by CDPR. I'm Sara Hayat. I work with climate change law and policy, and I've been working in the climate change domain for a while. But more importantly, I have here with me Dr. Abrar Chaudhry, who is a senior research fellow at the Said Business School at the University of Oxford. He researches there and also teaches postgrads sustainability and climate change, including climate finance. He's been in this sphere for about 15 years and is one of the first voices on climate change in Pakistan. So I'm thrilled to have you here with me today, Abrar.
Sara, thank you so much for inviting. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and look forward to this conversation.
Me too, even though it's Ramzan. I know.
Well, we'll keep it fresh.
Yes. So tell us, Abrar, what triggered your interest in climate change? Because 15 years ago, nobody was even talking about it, really. And how did you sort of, please trace your journey all the way to Oxford, because I know you're an accountant by training. And what makes it so special for you that you've made such a name for yourself in this area?
Yeah, I'm flattered. So thank you so much for that. I think 15 years ago, I also didn't know what climate really was. Actually, no one really spoke about climate, but I think we all felt it. You know, growing up in Lahore, I think one thing we all saw every year was, you know, we had these monsoons, which would, you know, invariably cause flooding. And then we would have time when it was very dry and very hot. So we were all kind of seeing a bit of change happening.
Absolutely.
So I trained as an accountant, as you said, and my life was really focused on, you know, working with clients, trying to solve issues, working with businesses to understand what they were really doing. But, you know, somewhere, I don't know how it happened, but, you know, in my kind of back of my head was always this thing about, or something's changing, you know, something's not right with the environment. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot was triggered initially was by the fact that, you know, every monsoons, Lahore would get flooded, right? We would have roads that were blocked. There were days there was no electricity. And I would ask this question. I said, you know, we know that monsoons are going to come at a certain time. Mm-hmm. Why is it that we're not doing anything about it? Why do we have to wait this entire year and then just have to wait it out? Mm-hmm. And I could never get an answer for that. And I thought, okay, something's wrong. I really need to understand that. Mm-hmm. And then fortunately, you know, how things would happen, I ended up in Oxford.
Okay.
Initially for a master's degree.
Okay. And a master's degree in what? So that if somebody else wants to go, they know.
Well, there are many pathways, but, okay, you know, naturally as an accountant, I thought business.
Right.
MBA would be the right choice, right? Right,
absolutely.
But so this was back in 2009 and 10. But while I was in Oxford in 2010, if you recall, we had, you know, massive flooding in Pakistan. I think that's the time where, if the stats are right, 1/5 of the country was underwater. A lot was happening. And I was
super floods,
right? Yeah. And I was in Oxford. So I asked everyone, even in Oxford, in Pakistan, I said, you know, what happened? Why do we have these super floods? Mm. And the answer I got was that, oh, no, this was an anomaly. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a flood of a century. Mm. And it doesn't happen. And there's nothing that we could have done to prevent it.
Yeah.
And I understand you can't really prevent it, but there was nothing that we could have done to
prepare for it.
Yeah. And that didn't seem like the right answer. Mm. And if you fast forward now, you know, we're in 2022, 12 years later, we had even a bigger flood.
Yeah.
Right? So it wasn't flood of a century. But that piqued my curiosity. So I said, you know what, I'm in Oxford. I've taken this time. I've worked for many years. Let me figure this out. And so I went to a school of geography that was right across the road.
Okay.
And I said, you know, I'm from Pakistan. There's floods here. I don't know anything about climate change, but I really want to understand, because I think this, what happened with Pakistan on this flooding was climate change. And they were kind enough. They were like, okay, maybe we'll take you in. So I got in. I started on my master's.
Right.
But as soon as I started, like, in that field, I was surrounded by policymakers. I was surrounded by scientists. And here I was, like, from a management consulting field. And that was quite rare, because everyone in that field was focused on, how, you know, to understand the science behind climate change and what is really happening. Mm-hmm. And for me, the bigger question was, yes, we need science. And I think we can, you know, coming from Pakistan, we can already see those impacts. And it's good we know more. Mm-hmm. But it was more about how do we solve for this? How do we mm-hmm. implement this? How do we, you know, find solutions? And I think that I kind of filled a gap in that world as well, okay. even in Oxford, right. because suddenly they were like, okay, that's not our responsibility. We as climate scientists, our responsibility is to understand the science, and we stop there.
Mm.
And someone else needs to do that. Yeah. And I was like, guys, I come from Pakistan. There's no one else there, right? There's no one else doing it, right? We're facing climate change. Yeah. And so who will do this? And so for me, that was the big question. And, you know, that world changed. Suddenly a new door opened.
Mm-hmm.
I spent the next 4 or 5 years traveling across the world.
Really?
In sub-Saharan Africa, Kenya, Senegal, like, you know. You
just understanding climate change, seeing it firsthand, yeah, experiencing it.
Exactly. And the approach I took was that, you know, in Pakistan, many parts of the world where, you know, governments dominate in some way, everything is top down.
Right.
So one way is to study, you know, you start at the top and you go mm. all the way on ground. And then I realized, actually, you know what? If you really want to understand climate and you want to see what climate is, mm. you have to see where climate meets the planet, where it meets people.
Okay.
It doesn't really meet policy, right? Because,
okay.
you know, you can't study climate at a policy level. You right. you apply policy to implement them.
Okay.
So I decided that the best way to do was just go on ground, find the most vulnerable places in the world,
mm-hmm.
and then just understand what's happening there. So I ended up going to, you know, all these sub-Saharan African countries. Mm-hmm. I went to Pakistan as well, Nepal, mm-hmm. Small farming communities that I feel are the most vulnerable
right.
are also the most important because, you know, they form the backbone Absolutely. Of society, of Absolutely. This world, mm-hmm. you know, just to give you a stat, right? 80% of developing country population or emerging country population is fed by 500 million small farms.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the ones who actually feed us
right.
And feed themselves. So if anything happens, this leads to extreme poverty.
Yeah, food instability through and through. Absolutely.
Exactly. So I spend a lot of time just being on ground. And that's how my journey started. And I'm happy to talk more about Wonderful. Where that journey went.
I'm really intrigued, to be honest, by you saying that sort of climate doesn't meet policy. Climate meets the planet. I work with climate policy, but I have to agree with you. And I like it. I like it's a great thought. And I like that you said that you learn on the ground because I've also learned most by meeting people who are sort of like really we're all impacted by climate change, but some more than others always. Right. So I think for the benefit of our audience, we have to clarify two things, which if you could please. One, climate change, the term, whether it's all encompassing. So you're going to be referring to or are you going to be referring to climate finance, sustainability, which I know you teach and specialize in sort of exclusively as well. So is it interchangeable? And also, I think everybody wants to know about climate finance. In Pakistan, a fad comes, and I think climate finance is the fad now, and the most important I think we've ever experienced, frankly. So, what is climate finance? What is the framework? Is the government the big fish? Are development organizations, you know, where the money's coming in? You know, who's sending the money? Who's receiving it? How do we get more of it?
It's a great question,
Big
but it's
question.
A huge question as well, right?
Yes.
And let me translate this into an example on the go.
Okay.
And I'll probably start from where I kind of ended. You know, imagine I, you know, was spending a lot of time with communities on ground. And so they're like these smallholder communities that were, you know, when I spoke to them, they said, something's changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were planting our seeds at a certain time, but no rains are coming in. Or when the rains come in, the intensity is very high.
Right.
And so what's the reason? How do we find out what's really happening? And really, that's what climate change is all about. It's, you know, when you look at climate change, it's about something's changing. The climate is shifting, it's changing, mm-hmm. and it translates into something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we all know that it translates, you know, when we talk about climate change, we're all talking about global warming, that the planet is warming up, right? There's a scientific element to that. But what is the impact of that warming mm-hmm. on ground? And that really is in things that we do, right? So practices that we do. So imagine if you're a smallholder farmer, there's a certain time that you have to plant your seeds for wheat. And if the rains don't come, then, you know, that seed is destroyed.
Right.
There's no food. So what climate is really doing is really impacting your existing development challenges. So it has a very strong link with what's happening on ground. So that's really what climate is. So when I was working with communities, I said, you know, why don't you do something different? Mm-hmm. How about you use a different type of seed? Or, you know, how can you get better information about when the rains will come in? And then the question is, okay, if we want to get more seeds, who's going to fund that money? Right. Where will that money come in?
Okay.
If you want better information about weather, you know, you need a small weather station there.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Someone needs to fund that weather station. And so really, anything that requires funding to deal with the impacts of climate change is what climate finance, in the simplest form.
Wonderful.
It's money that we need to deal with those challenges.
And including climate adaptation and mitigation.
Yeah. And those are also terms that I'm happy to explain.
Absolutely.
A little bit. Yeah. So when you look at the West, right, they all talk about carbon, emissions, net zero. We're hearing a lot of those terminologies. Mm-hmm. And those are really important things because, you know, through emissions, like through burning fossil fuels, you know, we release carbon, right?
Yeah.
And that carbon is really what's warming the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one side of it. So what the rest of the world is saying, okay, we need to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to stop emitting because if we keep emitting, you know, the world will keep warming up. You know, we'll go beyond 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees. And what research and policy says is that beyond 1.5, 2 degrees, we don't really know what the world will look like.
Absolutely.
There'll be tipping points. It will change.
And 2050 is doomsday.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we don't know because we've never lived in that temperature.
Right.
And so the world is scared, right? And they're saying, okay, let's stop that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stop emitting. And there's a whole host of challenges behind that, that, you know, we can't really go into detail, but there's an equity challenge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who should stop?
Mm-hmm.
You know, should the West stop? Should Pakistan stop? Should China stop? You know, there's a whole development element to it. So that's one aspect of it. But that's a very, I would say, a Western approach.
Okay.
Because they feel that they've developed and now we should stop emitting and, you know, where are all these emissions coming
from? I'm going to push back a little on this, Abraj. When you said the world is scared, is the West really scared? Because they seem to shift the burden onto I never like saying developing world. I always say the agricultural world, but the global South, really. And, you know, I feel like for them, it's not very high on the priority risk because they've adapted a little better or they are not experiencing the daily impacts of climate change the way we're living them.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right that their capacity to deal with these shocks is much higher.
Yeah.
But also what's really happening is that they also recognize that, you know, if they want a world where, you know, there's prosperity, there's economic development, the entire world has to converge, right? So if you're sitting in Europe, you're sitting in US, you're equally impacted by emissions that happen in China
100%.
Or India or Pakistan.
Yeah.
So the West recognized that if we want a world which is compatible with climate, we have to bring the rest of the world
on board. Right.
Now, the challenge here is not so much about the premise, but it's about equity. That, you know, why should China or Pakistan stop their development while the rest of the world has developed?
Yes.
And so, again, I think that's where climate finance also comes in because what Pakistan would say, okay, fine, I'm happy to stop my emissions, reduce my emissions. And Pakistan's made those amazing commitments that I think they want to reduce their emissions by 30%.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also saying, okay, someone needs to pay for this.
Yeah.
Because we should not be burdened with that payment. And that's, again, what climate finance is.
15% we're willing to reduce by our own money. And then the rest of the 35, in fact, I think we're going a little.
And I think Pakistan is doing that because it wants to be a good corporate citizen. It wants to show to the
world
that, you know, we are part of this entire world.
Yeah.
not that that 15% will make a huge difference to the world, but it will show that even countries like Pakistan, who don't necessarily have to focus on emission reduction, are doing something.
Yeah.
But the equity element is someone needs to fund that.
Right.
And so that's where the mitigation part comes in. It's important for the rest of the world, maybe not so much important for where we are right now in our development trajectory. Mm-hmm. But we also recognize that, you know, where the populations are going. So at some point, you know, stats say that maybe by 2070, Pakistan might be the sixth largest economy in the world.
Sixth largest economy?
Absolutely. I think the numbers coming in because of population growth,
right,
of the resources, of the development that's going to happen.
What about the brain drain? That doesn't count?
Hopefully the brain will come back, okay, right? Because because right, you go where resources are, right? You go where opportunities are. And we're seeing a reverse brain drain as well. Not for Pakistan at this moment, but imagine 50 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if Pakistan was to emit at the same level that the rest of the world is doing, you know, our emissions would probably be massive. So we know that we can leapfrog. We don't have to follow the same patterns that others have followed. There are better ways. So I agree with that, that if we have solar energy right now, why should we burn coal and fossil to get to the same outcome? Why can't we invest in solar? Because that technology is already there. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe like a long story that mitigation is important, but it's not necessary right now for Pakistan.
Okay.
But if you go on the other side, right, where actually my interest also lies is the adaptation side of it. That even, Sarah, if we stop all emissions right now, the world decided no more emission, right? You know, Earth is a living planet, right? It's a living thing. There's a lag. So whatever we've sent up already has an impact. So what will happen is that the Earth will keep warming. It will still go, even if we reduce everything right now. There's a lag time, but the impact for that is that, you know, suddenly your temperature is going up. You have flooding in Pakistan. You have drought in Africa. You have heat waves that we didn't have in Pakistan, you know. So we have to now find ways to deal with that. We have to live with that, which means, you know, our current infrastructure maybe doesn't allow us to do that, right? We need more cooling. We need more air conditioner coming in. Someone has to pay for that.
But that's a cycle, vicious cycle. Air conditioners will release aerosols, which are pollutants unto themselves.
Greenhouse gas. Yeah. And so all of this is connected. So you start to realize that if I want to solve for climate, it's not just about emissions, but it's also about helping people to deal with that. And I think we often forget that people are the most important aspect in climate, right?
Yeah.
They're the ones who feel, they're the ones who suffer, and they're the ones we have to serve. Okay, maybe I'll correct that. Along with the planet, right? We always forget that we share this planet with many other species. You know, so we have to focus on them, on those species as well. That if a temperature rises, you know, we lose biodiversity. I think everyone who's grown up in Lahore can see that part of it is development, part of it is climate, that we've lost the biodiversity we had, right?
Absolutely.
The bees or the butterflies or the birds or the parrots we had.
Because the trees are gone. We used to get, just don't see anymore.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So for me, adaptation is the big puzzle because really we can't get climate finance for that. No one wants to spend money on adaptation.
Right. Although, and I think this is a debate ongoing whether adaptation is more important for the developing world, agricultural world, or whether mitigation should be where all the money comes in. But just for the benefit of everybody listening and my own, where is the bank with the climate finance and who has the ATM card to get that money out?
Okay.
Yeah.
So clearly not the governments.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially governments in emerging economies.
Right.
And the reason I say that is that climate is one of the many, many issues that governments have to deal with, right? So in Pakistan, we've got health, we have education, we have development, infrastructure, you name it. Yes, climate is a cross-cutting thing. So I tell every ministry, I said, you know, guys, we don't really need one ministry of climate change. We need Ministry of Climate Change embedded in each and every ministry. Because it's cross-cutting, right?
Yes.
So climate on its own doesn't mean much. It's climate and agriculture. It's climate and water. So we really have to start thinking about these cross-cutting issues. But when we bring another cross-cutting lens within the existing challenges, right? Mm-hmm. It adds so much more pressure because you need the expertise, you need money. So, so governments are strained. They have a role. They have a very, very important role. But I feel financing should not be their primary role. I think what they have to do is facilitate, give policy, support, you know, help push the sector forward. Okay. And yes, do their development funding, but alone they can't. On the other side, we have governments, right? The developed world governments that have made a commitment. You know, under the Paris Agreement, there's a commitment to send money to emerging economies.
But not a legally enforceable commitment. No. That's the thing.
Yeah. But the fact that we've agreed on something is but it's not legally enforceable at all.
Yeah.
So which is a challenge, right? Because countries like Pakistan can't enforce it. So what we have to do is carry on negotiating, carry on communicating. Communicating.
Yes.
So on the other hand, you have countries that are committed or have committed or should commit to send all this money in.
Right.
And it hasn't been coming at the same pace.
And this is the global north.
This is the global north. Right. And it hasn't been coming at the same pace that's required because, you know, the scale of the challenge is huge. Like, I think the current estimate is that, you know, we need something like $6 trillion just to get to a low emission pathway. And right now, the world is spending $1 trillion.
$6 trillion globally or $6 trillion just amongst?
$6 trillion globally. By 2030. And this is per year.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So we need $6 trillion per year on very conservative estimates.
Okay.
Right now, we have about $1 trillion.
Okay.
And out of that $1 trillion that's being spent on climate change, 5% or 7% is spent on adaptation. So 95 or 94% goes to mitigation side of it.
Okay.
And then within that adaptation, very little money comes to countries that are most vulnerable. So you can start to see it as a big funnel and the money becomes smaller and smaller. And the reason is that, of course, you know, the global north, the global north hasn't committed or hasn't lived up to his promise, but they have their own socioeconomic challenges.
Of course.
Like if you are sitting in UK and if there's homelessness in UK and suddenly you write a check of $100 million for Pakistan, their population start to demand their government, how are you doing this? So a lot of these countries sadly are started to walk away from their international commitments and are looking domestically.
Okay.
So then I land on my final piece. I think where the money, as you said, who holds the wallet, right?
Right.
Where's the ATM?
Yeah.
I think the ATM is with organizations that can benefit from this as well, right?
Okay.
Climate is no longer just a threat. And I don't want to frame it, though it's a huge opportunity. Mm. But what climate offers is a new way of working, a new way of operating. And when you have a new way of working, that's where opportunities emerge, right? Mm-hmm. That's where new things emerge. That's where entrepreneurs come in because we have to deal with a different world. And so I finally, after 15 years of research, I said, you know what? Actually, we need all these actors, but private sector has to sit in the middle of this change. And the reason I say private sector is because they're the ones who are actually running the economy. They're the ones who will actually see these changes happen.
Okay.
And I think they can be instrumental in shifting it. And maybe final point, because they're the ones who are emitting the most as well. You know, if you look at some of the figures, just 100 companies are responsible for 70% of the emissions.
Yes.
So they're the ones who have to be part of the solution as well. They can't look at the government or they look at NGOs and say, you know what, this is not our responsibility. You deal with climate. No, you have to be part of it. You have to solve for it. Mm-hmm. And you are the ones who can create a new economy out of this whole challenge. And I think that's for me is also very exciting. How do I engage with private sector to tell them, hey, this is a moment in history where things will transition. And we don't see those transitions happen often, right? You have industrial revolutions or you have IT revolutions. Now we'll have a new form of entrepreneurs and industry. And Pakistan can really benefit from that.
I am just going to reiterate what Abrar has said here because it's so important, especially if you're a student, an entrepreneur, if you're just entering the profession, if you intend to make a shift. Climate change is the new world, right? We're all living climate change and it is beautiful in its proportions, and it is scary, but it is also an avenue of opportunity. And, you know, like, he's at Oxford and he's studying climate change, which is kind of amazing because we almost always have foreign technocrats helping us in Pakistan. And it's great that, you know, like, he's an authority and he's Pakistani and he's brown. And, you know, we want more Pakistanis to be studying climate change, to be working in this area. And so I hope, like, you know, if there's a student or if you're a startup or if you're a company, that you will branch out into helping the world and combating climate change is kind of crucial. The other thing I just want to say for the benefit of the audience is that Abrar has referred to using climate finance for mitigation and adaptation purposes. Mitigation means curbing greenhouse gas emissions from the source, like basically khatam karna unko. And adaptation means adjusting to how climate change is affecting our lifestyle, our living, daily living. And it is a catch-22 whether mitigation is more important or adaptation is more important. But he's saying that, you know, for the global north, most money is being targeted towards mitigation. Whereas I would like to say here, and as an advocate for Pakistan almost always, that we need to focus on adaptation. And so we need climate finance for adaptation. Abrar says about 7% of global climate finance is channeled towards adaptation, which is very, very less. But on something, coming towards something else, and Oxford University, I think, always, you know, a positive thing to think about. I'm sure you meet a lot of people from different parts of the world, all, you know, sort of foremost thinkers and experts and working in the climate domain and climate industry and business and science and what's the narrative around climate change there? What are they doing that we aren't doing here? Like, what are they talking about that we are missing out on?
Yes, Sarah, I want to pick up on one point you were saying for, you know, for young people. Because I think that's being at a university, you know, you meet young people all the time, right? Students coming in. I teach on some of those courses as well. And maybe 5 years ago, people were interested in this space. They wanted to learn more about it. But there were not many opportunities out there for them to get a job. And honestly, in the last 5 years, especially after COVID, things have changed dramatically because suddenly we started to recognize how vulnerable and sensitive this planet is and how quickly things can change dramatically. And for me, honestly, the biggest energy I get is meeting with young people because they come in, they're the ones who have all these new ideas. Right. If someone came to me and said, you know what, I'm a climate expert working in this field for 15, 20 years, that's not really true because really a lot wasn't happening then. They might have been working in allied fields. So what's really exciting is that this is a field where anyone can enter right now. It's not dominated. There isn't experience. There isn't a lot of people who are out there. So I tell young people, just go in, learn. And the best way to learn is, honestly, is to learn from the ground. It's really going to the source and saying, I want to understand what the challenge is.
But right, to just clarify it for the audience, how should they get to the source? Like, should they join an organization? Should they go through a university?
Sure. I think it's good. I'm glad that you're putting like a little bit more structure. Okay. I think there are lots of programs coming in. There are lots of organizations coming in. I'm also being asked to do lots of research, right? Or lots of other programs here. I think the best way to do it is we live in this climate. We are living in this climate crisis right now, right? Yeah. And I think what's really important is to really get and understand why things are happening, right? If you're working in a government agency, you know, you can ask governments, you know, what are the actions that they're taking. A lot of people are working in industry or businesses. So they have to understand, you know, how is the products that they're creating impacted by climate change? Or what are the impacts these products create on the environment? Or if you're working with communities, really understand what are some of the challenges you're facing. So I think the opportunity we have here in Pakistan, and I'll come to your question, I promise, because, you know, is that, you know, what the West requires, when I'm sitting at Oxford, what they really are looking for is, they'll ask me abroad, what's happening on ground? Because you come from a country that experiences, you know, huge impacts of climate change, right? We go up in the north and we have glaciers, right? Which are melting. So if people are traveling, I tell everyone, going to Hunza or going to Gilgit, talk to people there, ask the communities, what is changing here? How are they seeing the temperatures change? Or how are they seeing the environment around them change? Mm-hmm. And what sort of measures are they taking? Because remember, as humans, we always adapt.
Right, of course.
Good or bad. The challenge right now is the scale is so big that it's overwhelming us. But over a period of time, we have been adapting. Mm-hmm. So in Oxford, people ask me, okay, what's happening on ground? How can we learn from this? Mm-hmm. How can we develop ideas? So I think that's one thing that I'm learning. And I'm saying, okay, you know, go to Pakistan, you know, talk to people there, you know, build projects there, build research projects there. So if you're a university student, reach out. Say, you know, I'm from this country, you know, I can offer you data. Like what we can offer is real data, what's really happening. But other than that, so it's young people, right? So I'm seeing talent being developed.
Right.
You know, one of the big things that I'm thinking about is like, how do we develop more of this green talent? The other thing that's happening a lot is that now businesses are coming to us.
Okay.
Like previously, 5-6 years ago, when I would speak to business, because I sit at the business school and I was at the School of Geography as well. So I sit in the intersection between business and climate. 5 years ago, when I would talk to businesses and say, you know, this is climate is really important. They would say, yeah, it's important, but, you know, it's not our priority right now. Mm-hmm. Our priority is, you know, other challenges as well. Mm-hmm. Now they're coming to us. And the reason why they're coming to us is because few things are happening that's changing the dynamics, right? First, customer demand is shifting to some extent. You know, customers, consumers are coming to companies and saying, you know, we will not buy a product if it's not sustainable. Or at least they're asking. They're asking those questions, you know, is this product sustainable? Is there any child labor behind this? You know, has it, you know, contributed to pollution? So there's more transparency. And so businesses have to respond to that genuine demand. Because as a customer, I have a right to ask what's happening, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, policies are shifting.
Okay.
And policies are shifting because we are living, or we our trajectory is in a direction where we know that if it gets to 2 degrees, you know, we wouldn't have glacial melt or you know, these tipping points will happen, or coral reefs would die, or our fish stock would die. Like, it's dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of regulation has started to come in saying, okay, we need to first disclose what businesses are doing, and then we need to do something about it. So there's consumer push coming in, there's regulation coming in. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, these companies exist of people and humans like us who don't want to destroy the planet. So you go to any company and say, you know what, is your goal? Do you want profits, or do you want to destroy the planet?
Mm-hmm.
They will come back and say, you know what, actually we want sustainable profits. So they've started to ask this question, what does sustainable profit mean? So that push has started to come in, and that engagement is happening where you're saying, okay, now let's find a solution. Let's see how does climate actually meet businesses? What we can measure and calculate. But the big question is, what does that mean for a business, right? So, for example, if you are producing a product that's not great for the environment, are you as a businessman, as you as a leader, ready to say, okay, I'm going to stop. I will no longer produce this product.
And are people stopping?
I think they're starting to talk about this, right? This is the big existential question that's coming in.
Right.
That there's certain products that oil, for example, you know, we can't have a world where we can still be burning oil at the same level and expect to be under 1.5 degree.
Right.
So this big question is coming to oil companies. Okay, guys, this product is not great. Will you stop this product? And they'll say, of course, they'll say no for now. But what they'll also say is, okay, let's find a transition. Let's find a way to start to transition out of oil. And I think those are the conversations that I've just started. And businesses are coming and saying, okay, give us the right science, but also it's like change management, right? Give us a way to transition out and develop different products or different ideas.
But isn't that very expensive, though? I mean, because I feel like in Pakistan, and I noticed definitely there's a consumer demand for, or there's consumer awareness, let's say, for more eco-friendly products or green products, or, you know, products that are very harmful for the environment. But when it comes to actually sort of purchasing them, you have a very real obstacle, which is that, you know, greener products tend to be a little more steep, like they're more
heavy. I think there's some misconception behind it, and I'd love to clarify that.
Definitely.
First, I would say that all products should be green. So consumers should not have a choice where a product should come in, which is bad for the environment. And the reason why it's cheaper is because the environment has not been priced in. So, for example, you might be producing a product where you're using a lot of water or you have a lot of wastewater. And what you're really doing is you're just polluting and you're throwing that water away.
Mm.
But that should have been priced in the product because it's causing some pollution. Because when it's priced in, then you know that this is the true price of a product or the true value of a product. And so we don't know that. So the reason they're cheaper right now is they're not priced in. So that's one aspect. Mm-hmm. The other aspect is maybe a little bit more philosophical, but I think there's an economic case behind it as well. What's good for the planet is good for profit. Anything. Okay. So what is sustainability, right? When we define sustainability, and I know you asked me this question right at the start, but really sustainability is focusing on the present, that we generate profits, but we also think about the future. So I'm saying I'm going to generate profits, but I want to make sure that the people who come after me can also generate profits. So if I have a forest, if I cut down that forest, I would generate huge profits, but I've left nothing for anyone else. That's not sustainable.
Okay.
But if I went to a forest and I maybe cut some branches or I cut some trees and I planted more trees back in, that's sustainable. So what sustainability is saying is, you know, just change your time horizon. Move away from the short term, look at the long term. So if I tell you, Sarah, that, you know, you can set up a business where actually I can help you reduce your energy. You should be using less energy. You should be using less water. You should be recycling your products. You don't have to create lots of products or use lots of material. That would eventually lead to lower costs. Because you're using less resources.
But what about the initial cost?
And I think, okay, fair point.
Right.
And thank you for pushing me on this. That's where government policy comes in.
Right.
That's where governments have to come in and say, we know that this is a great product and this eventually will get to the right place. But it's not affordable right now. So how do we help push this project forward, right? And I don't like to use the word subsidy because I think it has a very kind of negative connotation that a subsidy is coming without value. But what you're really doing is you're helping accelerate innovation. That's where climate finance needs to come in, because what climate finance is coming in and saying, this is a great product that should be in the market, but because it's priced high, I'm going to help you. I'm going to bring in this lower financed money, cheaper or concessional finance, and we'll get your product at this level. But once this product is here, climate finance has to go out, because now we made it mainstream. And I think that's where commercial money has to come in. And we've seen this with solar, right? For many years, solar was not viable, right? 10 years ago, if you wanted a solar panel on your home, the payback period was 20 years. So you would say, okay, why should I invest ₹1 million? And there's absolutely no benefit. But right now, if you go and speak to someone, they'll say, actually, it's fantastic. In 6 months, my return comes in, because the energy prices have gone in. And the reason the energy prices have gone is because we are using precious resources. So we needed climate finance then. And that's exactly what happened. You know, you could get a concession, or you would get a lower price or a credit if you wanted to buy solar panels rest of the world. And once the technology started to ramp up, you know, the price of production starts to go down. And so I think that's where climate finance and policy has to come in. They have to be very targeted.
Right.
But at the heart of it was private sector innovation. Someone decided, a private sector entrepreneur decided that I'm going to put up a solar plant and then we will innovate on that. And they go to university and say, can you help us with research? So you start to bring all these actors together, but the driver is
the private sector,
because they have a motivation.
Right. So according to Abrar here, we need the private sector to basically finance a climate crisis. I can't put it more simply. And but I do want to ask one question here. If you speak with the private sector, they always, most of them, and Abrar and I have been working together on something also. So, and which is why I can say this, like the private sector does tend to want full support from government policy. And they do feel that, we are lacking in government policies, or we have I'd like to say that we have the policies, we have the policy framework, we even have the regulatory framework, really, but we don't have the enforcement.
And I couldn't agree with you more, because I think government has a role to play.
Right.
You know, many of those policies have to be implemented, right? But policy alone cannot drive all of this action, right?
Okay.
Policy is one lever. As I said, one lever across many levers that we need for something to change. And I'll give you an example. Maybe this is coming from our study, but I did go recently and visited a textile where, you know, for all textiles, or, you know, if you're a global buyer, you know, you require the textile manufacturer not to waste water, or to treat the wastewater that the dyeing unit is generating. And that's fair, because, you know, it's bad for the environment. It's bad for the product. And so they require textiles to put up an effluent plant, you know, to clean the wastewater and then discharge it. And that's important. And these are expensive plants, right?
Yes.
And so I went to a mill. They were doing a fantastic job. But guess what? You know, the water is being discharged in a canal that's already very polluted.
Right.
So really, what was the purpose of doing this? Then for me, that's kind of greenwashing, because really what's happening is, in a way, from a customer's perspective, that they say, oh, you know what? We have a product that does not, you know, the waste has been treated.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the waste has been treated and thrown into something that's bad for the environment. So it's really not helped the environment. And that's where government policy, it's not the fault of the factory. They're doing whatever they can. But the canal itself is the responsibility of the government. They have to enforce that all of the factories are not polluting. Mm-hmm. But I think often our approach is, regulation, more regulation, right? Enforcing regulation requires more resources. Instead, what the government could have done is, they could have put that money in, set up one effluent plant that all the industry could have used.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's also about, like, what's the lever they want to use, right? And I think often our lever has been enforcement. Okay. And we know that, you know, governments around the world, not just Pakistan, around the world, have a lot of challenges enforcing policies. But I think by converting it into an opportunity, they could actually help reduce that cost.
Yes, absolutely. I think I love that the theme for our podcast today has been that climate change is scary and climate change is an opportunity. I mean, everybody should just view it like that, really. Abrar, one last question before I think I'll sum it up. The question is so I feel like in Pakistan, we tend to hide behind a narrative that we are not the primary or foremost contributors to global warming, right? And in fact, Pakistan contributes about less than 0.8% to global greenhouse gas emissions, which sort of gives us, and fairly, like, gives us some margin to say, you know what, health is more important, or the economy is more important, or XYZ, you know, and we put climate change on the back burner, and the global north should take up this battle, so to speak. Do you agree with that? And because you have the advantage of knowing the Western perspective, really, the global North perspective, how do they feel about the global South saying something like this?
I think the challenge here is that we've used this approach of being a victim, right? And I totally agree. You know, we are climate victims,
right?
Because we didn't cause this, right? And we're just at the cusp of moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine you're at the cusp of moving forward and a massive flood comes in and one third of the country is gone. You know, who should we blame? Should we blame ourselves? Yes, to some extent, but, you know, we couldn't have prevented that. So, so I totally understand the rationale. Sadly, the, the world doesn't look at us or the rest of the world like this, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, what happens is today is, and this is what climate is doing, right? Today is Pakistan. Tomorrow it's East Africa, a drought there, flooding in Nigeria, flooding in Libya, flooding in so many of those countries. So these disasters will keep rising. Mm. And the world sympathizes, but then moves very quickly to the next challenge. Absolutely. And I think if we were to touch their hearts, we will go nowhere. Right.
Okay.
And for me, that's been the big change, right? This is what I've seen and I've noticed what other countries are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've started to do is, okay, fine. We will keep the stance that, you know, you are responsible. We will not let you off.
Mm-hmm.
So the loss and damage fund or the adaptation fund, all the funds that need to come in from the global north, that they have to make that commitment. You keep that pressure on, but you have to start meeting them somewhere as well. We can't just sit here and expect the world to come to us and meet us here. No, we have to change that. So the countries that have been smart, and, you know, again, I think we were discussing before as well, you know, Bangladesh is a classic example. And the reason we use Bangladesh is it is one of the most vulnerable countries. But what they've done is, what they decided was, how do we start to move towards where the world wants us, right?
Okay.
And what does the world want? They want transparency. They want systems. They want some funding to come in. They've been very smart that they actually use their textile industry. Like, one of the very interesting projects that Bangladesh got, I think it was from the Green Climate Fund, over $200 million, was that, you know, their textile industry came together and said, you know, why can't we apply for funding to the Green Climate Fund? And then use that funding to reduce our energy emissions, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they all came together. The industry came together. Their association came together. They put up a project. They did all that work. And then they went to the world and said, okay, we need this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Pakistan also needs to do is we need to know what we want. We can't just wait and expect the world to send us money. They'll say, okay, fine, you want money. What do you want the money for? Okay, how will this help you deal with the changes of climate change? And that's what I'm noticing sitting there, that we can't use the victim lens. We have to be proactive.
Okay.
We have to come up with our own solutions, because these are our problems. And we have to tell the West, or the private sector in the West, or the countries in the West, or multilaterals, or the World Bank, this is what exactly we need.
Hmm.
Okay, we don't have capacity. Okay, we need this money for this specific capacity for this outcome. We just can't say, oh, we need capacity building on climate. Okay, to what end? What are we trying to achieve? If I went and said, oh, I need capacity building in the textile sector to build products that are climate resilient, and this is where I need funding. Okay, we have a problem with our dyeing plants, right? Or we have a problem with energy efficiency, or we have a problem with how we grow cotton. Can you help us specifically for this project? And this is how this will translate and connect. So I think that's what we need to do. And this is sometimes what's lacking, that Pakistan doesn't have a concrete action plan.
Yeah.
And it's expected that others will do their homework.
Hmm.
Sadly, that's not the case, because the world moves on. And they'll move on to countries that have done better homework, that have their own structures together. They have their own coordination together. Like, I've been in meetings, honestly, Sarah, where, you know, you sit in a meeting and you sit with credible funders, and, you know, you get the sense that the negotiating party from the country hasn't aligned itself. They don't know what they're asking for. So, you know, what would the funder say?
Right.
They'll say, let's do it again. First, you go back, spend some time.
Prepare a pitch
and tell us. No one is going to give you money if you don't have a pitch. And I say, you know, please, sir, give me money, because, you know, I'm a victim.
Hmm.
But if I came with a business plan to you and said, I am a victim, but I'll tell you how I will move out of this. Yeah. Here's my business plan. This is the money I require. This is what I'm actually going to do. This is my marketing plan. This is the product. Honestly, you will listen to me, because now I'm solving two problems. I'm solving my victim problem that will touch your heart, but I'm also solving a financial challenge that will touch your brain.
Yeah.
And so you'll say, okay, fine, this meets my heart and brain. Let's do it abroad. Wow. So I think that's what we need to do.
Amazing. I think I'm going to again reiterate what he said. So what he's basically saying is don't rely on playing the emotional sort of card anymore. You can call it the victim card, which is like the emotional card, but instead have like a solid plan. And you can't just get money anymore or climate finance anymore on the basis of being, you know, Pakistani and third world or whatever. You need to show what you're going to do with the money, what climate change is doing to you, and how you're going to use the money to improve, basically. Thank you so much, Abrar. This was so insightful. Just to sum up, and if there's something else you want to add, but I think we still have a couple more minutes, we have enough, traffic jams are long enough for people to listen to a longer podcast. But we've covered why the world needs climate finance, why Pakistan needs climate finance, who should be sending in the climate finance, i.e. the global north, and the global south should be receiving it. We've covered the limited role of the government really in receiving climate finance, and how Abrar feels very strongly that the private sector should be right at the heart of the system and should be the one steering change, should be the one pooling in money, especially because, you know, they are the real corruptors. So it's kind of like the polluter pays principle. And we've also spoken about the intersection of business with climate change, how consumer demand is changing globally, that, you know, green, all products should be green products. Really, there should just not be enough choice anymore for you to purchase something that is not green and that's not helping the environment. We've spoken about transparency, about sustainable reporting for businesses, and how policy is shifting and forcing and pushing sort of businesses to adapt greener or to make greener commitments. And we also learned about Dr. Abrar Chaudhry's journey all the way from Lahore in accountancy to climate change, something he wants you all to do as well. Leave your boring jobs and work with climate change. We have also, and I do want to push on this for students, if you're listening, parents who have children coming out into the real sort of tough world. Please opt to work in the climate domain. There is a lot of opportunity. There is a lot of work to be done. We all need you. The planet needs you. You know, you need you to do this. So please sort of make climate change a priority all around. Thank you, Abrar, so much. This was wonderful. I hope that you will have a lovely trip, the rest of your trip. You won't get stuck in any traffic jams. You'll eat good food. The weather will remain clement. And that we will see you soon in Lahore again.
Thank you, Sarah. And it was a pleasure. And nice. I think the great thing is the skies are blue.
Yeah.
And when you go out, it reminds you how beautiful Lahore is, how beautiful this planet is.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we can all do something about it. So thank you for that summary. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.